Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Eric von Kutzum for an update on new research findings in colorectal and gastric cancer. And to begin, Dr. von Kutzum commented on emerging data on a new anti-angiogenic strategy, the VEGF trap aflibercept.
The clinical data on aflibercept, they're interesting. The only large study that we have is the VELOR study. That's a phase 3 study in second line, oxaliplatin pretreated patients, where all endpoints were met in this randomized study of FOLFIRI plus or minus aflibercept. Primary endpoint was survival. There was a difference in response rate, and that's pretty interesting in that sense that response rate in second line went up from 11 to 20%, so almost a doubling of the response rate, with adding an anti-angiogenic agent to a chemotherapy backbone. And then there was a prolongation of the progression-free survival in second line. That's limited to second line, of course. That was in oxaliplatin pretreated patients. We did some further analysis on to understand what was the significance of bevacizumab pretreated or not pretreated patients. One third of the patients were pretreated with bevacizumab, two thirds were not. In the subgroup analysis, we saw a similar trend of benefit for adding aflibercept in the bevacizumab pretreated versus not pretreated patients. And that raises some interesting questions, such as, is aflibercept more active than bevacizumab? Or is it the proof or the suggestion that post-progression continuation of an anti-angiogenic agent benefits patients? We know that we do have some data from the BRIGHT Expanded Access program presented by Exagrotti and others, looking in a non-randomized way at patients treated in first line with the chemo backbone plus bevacizumab, and in second line, then the cohort of patients with another chemo backbone plus bevacizumab versus chemo without bevacizumab versus no treatment. We saw in this setting that there was a prolongation of the survival. That's not a proof, although this strategy is adopted frequently in the US, but that's not a hard scientific proof because it's not a randomized study.
Isn't there a large randomized trial looking at the issue of continuation of Bev on disease progression?
Yes, that's a large randomized trial that was done in Europe, 800 patients. All patients were treated in first line with an oxaliplatin or irinotecan backbone plus bevacizumab. And then in second line, there was a randomization, continuation of bevacizumab or no bevacizumab, and the chemo backbone was changed. So that's a randomized trial, 800 plus patients. All patients were clearly progressive under the first line. So that should answer in an evidence-based way the question post-progression continuation or not of bevacizumab. The primary endpoint in this trial is now survival, to have a strong endpoint. Wow. So in that trial, it's planned to be reported at ASCO this year, 2012. And that will elucidate and give an important picture also on this question of post-progression continuation. Again, that will not be a head-to-head comparison of bevacizumab versus aflibercept.
Right.
But in this setting, the interpretation of the aflibercept data, right, we will have to see that in view of the slightly higher toxicity of aflibercept compared to bevacizumab, it's going to be a very important and relevant question in this setting and for the strategy of the treatment of colorectal cancer.
So getting back to aflibercept, so obviously we want to know this trial you're talking about with the bevacizumab actually will be informative in terms of aflibercept. Is this some kind of cross resistance thing that's doing something that Bev doesn't do, or just continued anti-angiogenesis helps? I guess it's kind of hard to tell with a placebo-controlled trial, but any sense about the magnitude of anti-tumor benefit that aflibercept is adding here? First of all, does it seem to be clinically worthwhile based on the data, and any way to indirectly compare it to bevacizumab?
Yeah, well, the trial, it was a large trial. All endpoints were met. The magnitude of the benefit was not spectacular. If you look at survival, it's a second-line trial. The median survival benefit was less than 2 months in the trial. So the magnitude is not spectacular. But usually, if you look in oncology, colorectal cancer, but as well as other cancers, it's usually a step-by-step. And the challenge will be, again, to find out which are the right patients. And for some patients, this will be clinically relevant. For some others, it will not be clinically relevant, especially if they have more toxicity. And that's the next step, let's say, to find the best strategy to place that in this situation. But with aflibercept and bevacizumab, and now here the regorafenib data being presented at this meeting also, we have now three angiogenesis inhibitors with an activity, all a different mechanism of activity. But bevacizumab most often studied in first line, some second line data. Aflibercept studied in second line. Regorafenib studied in last line trials. So that's going to be interesting. So that will be give, let's say, a revival to strategic trials, which are extremely difficult and challenging to see for the benefit of patients, because every time, if you look back to colorectal cancer, every time a new drug was introduced, we saw a benefit of 2 to 3 months, a median benefit. The question is that going to happen in the continuum of care also with the introduction of aflibercept and regorafenib? With regorafenib, it seems so, because this regorafenib trial that's presented here was in patients resistant to bevacizumab, to all the cytotoxics, and in the wild-type patients also resistant to an anti-EGFR antibody. And in this setting, there was an improvement in survival, with some patients having a quite long survival. So in the continuum of care, these different anti-angiogenic agents and the new anti-angiogenic agents may play an important role.
So I was going to ask you about regorafenib that Axel Grothe is presenting here. From what I can tell, multi-kinase TKI. And I remember back there was another one called PTK something that Randy Heck. Is it similar to that?
It's not completely similar. It seems to be preclinically.
Because that was negative.
That was negative. But a couple of remarks. PTK is also called vatalanib. That was studied in two large phase 3 studies, a first line and a second line study, but always in combination with chemo backbone. So this raises some interesting questions. One, we know that preclinically, regorafenib seems to be a bit better than vatalanib, preclinically. If you look at the inhibition of the different receptors and the strength of inhibition, that seems to be a bit better than vatalanib.
Is it mainly VEGF?
It's mainly VEGF, correct. But the question that is also raised is, what about the interaction with the chemo backbone and the setting? This is the first large trial, to my knowledge, where one of these TKIs was studied a single agent in refractory patients. In the past, there was vatalanib, there was cidaranib, was presented last year, there was sunitinib. All different TKIs were always studied in combination with chemotherapy. And some of these, not for sunitinib, but at least for cidaranib, and to a minor extent, but also to some extent, vatalanib, they had some activity. But the activity was not large enough to beat bevacizumab. But bevacizumab was at least as active, but was less toxic. And there is the difficult issue, is combination the best strategy, or the regimens at least that have been studied, are they the most optimally designed trials?
I got to say, I feel a little bit better about regorafenib after talking to you, because when I read the abstract, I was thinking, wow, this doesn't look too impressive. But now you're bringing up the fact that it was so late line and it was by itself.
Yeah, I think if you will see the data, it's by itself. It's quite impressive, because this patient population was optimally selected. Patients needed to have clearly progression, needed to have been exposed really through all different agents available in colon cancer, and that had to be documented to have a clear-cut population. That reminded me when we did a trial a little bit to the early days when we did cetuximab in the chemo-refractory patients, where really you had to document that the patients were really resistant to irinotecan before you could put them on cetuximab to have as clean as possible population. And this trial, with more than 700 patients, recruitment went so fast.
Did you put patients on?
Yes, yes.
Are there any kind of like EGFR and lung cancer mutation kind of Lazarus-like effects where you give this agent and you see a great response that lasts a long time?
In some patients, you don't see spectacular responses. You see some minor tumor regressions, but you see in some patients that they were progressive and that then remained stable there. with a minor response for 1 year, 1 year and a half or longer. So you see that in some patients and that they improve also clinically. You don't see like with anti-EGFR targeted agents, tumor shrinking largely. So it's minor responses or tumor stabilizations, but really long lasting tumor stabilizations where you see the course of the disease changing in some of these patients because they were clearly progressive and then you stop them from growing.
So what's the next step for regorafenib, and do you see it becoming clinically available at some point?
I'm assuming
aflibercept is likely to become available.
Yeah, my expectations is aflibercept has been filed. My expectations is that regorafenib will be filed because the trial meets all the criteria. It's a population with an unmet need.
You think this trial is enough to get it used? To get it approved?
Yes, that's what I think. So the data are strong. Everything is set up to meet all the criteria for strong registration. It's 700-patient trial. The difference is not borderline. It's clearly statistically significant. It met all the criteria. So, yeah, I expect this will be and should be approved.
So I want to go into a couple other final topics. But first, any interest in the research community in combining anti-angiogenics, for example, a TKI and antibody? You know, there was a lot of interest in that in renal. That doesn't seem to sort of play out. What about in GI cancers?
In GI cancers, there was not a lot of interest for that because until the regorafenib data being presented here, we were not so enthusiastic about the activity on the TKIs. If you combine them with chemotherapy, you saw already a bit more toxicity in this setting. In colon cancer, bevacizumab on itself without the cytotoxic backbone is not active. So, yeah, that's not the first step I would do. I would rather look at smarter combinations than just combining two, at least of the existing classes of anti-angiogenic agents.
So a couple of final questions about topic that keeps coming up in every cancer, which is tissue assays. And let's start out with where we are with KRAS testing. I can vaguely remember you doing the ASCO plenary presentation a couple years ago when KRAS and changed the way practice is done in terms of EGFR antibodies. Where are we today with that? And also, what's going on with some of these new sort of mutations that people are finding that maybe do respond?
Yeah, I think the KRAS story is consolidated today, and we can summarize that with saying that KRAS mutation is a good predictor for resistance. That's the better word. That patients with KRAS mutant tumors should not be treated with an anti-EGFR antibody because they will not derive any benefit from that. Recently, we know that KRAS mutations occur mainly on codon 12, 70 to 80% of the mutations on codon 13. It's 15 to 20% of the mutations, and then a little bit on a few mutations, a few percentage of the mutations on codon 61. What has recently been published and also presented are some data regarding mutations on the codon G13D. That's a specific mutation that is present in 15 to 20% of the tumors. What our group has initially shown is in a retrospective analysis in the chemorefractory patients, and that was the JAMA paper at the end of 2010. In chemorefractory patients, we saw sometimes some exceptions. Some patients with a KRAS mutant tumor that responded to cetuximab. So then we went further into some details, and what we have seen is that the patients with the mutation on G13D, that they had a similar benefit than the wild-type patients, so that they behaved different than patients with the mutation of codon 12. That was in the chemorefractory population. That was the first part of the retrospective analysis. That's for sure not enough to recommend in clinical practice to treat a patient with a G13D with cetuximab.
It's not?
It's not enough. The second part of the story was that we then did some preclinical experiments in cell lines. Cell lines with the mutation on the codon 13 versus cell lines with the mutation on codon 12. And in these cell lines, we saw that they behaved also different. These experiments were done in Italy, that they behaved different. The 13 versus the 12, the 13 who could benefit compared to the 12 who did not benefit on cetuximab, which was in line with the initial data in chemorefractory patients. The third part of the story was then that we did then an analysis of Crystal and Opus. We went back to the mutations.
That was the first-line studies.
That's the first-line studies. With cetuximab. We went back into the data and we looked at patients with the mutation on codon 13. And we saw also that these patients had a similar benefit than the wild-type patients, while patients with a mutation on the codon 12 had no benefit. Again, that are retrospective studies.
But that was a prospective study.
The study was prospective, but the analysis is retrospective.
We do that with Oncotype and breast.
That's correct. To have proof of this, I think, and before giving a general recommendation that we can treat patients with a G13D mutation with cetuximab, I think a prospective study should be done. And that's actually ongoing in Australia right now. It's a prospective study to look at patients with a G13D mutation to see whether they have benefit from cetuximab or not in the chemorefractory setting. With panitumumab, they did also an analysis, a retrospective analysis of the different trials with panitumumab, and they could not find the same findings.
So do you think that's like some problem with the difference with the data or the way the trial's done, or is it fundamentally different?
We don't have a good explanation. Some have suggested that the drugs are different and may be different, and even some suggestions that ADCC, which is there for cetuximab and not there for panitumumab, may be part of the explanation. I don't believe that's the whole explanation.
What about using an EGFR antibody, specifically cetuximab, in a patient with an exon 13 mutation?
We have treated some patients off-label. We have clearly to say that it's not in the indication. That's not the general recommendation that they should put in guidelines. But we have treated some patients off-label in this situation and have seen some benefit in some
really?
Patients.
Really? Interesting. So final question is about biomarkers in the adjuvant setting, particularly stage 2, but also for that matter, stage 3. Where are we today with MMR, Oncotype, and Coloprint?
Difficult topic. I think MSI testing, MMR testing, so looking for MSI or MSS status is probably relevant in stage 2 colon cancer. It is clearly a prognostic factor. Patients with a microsatellite instable tumor, an MSI tumor, have a better outcome. That is clear. I don't think with the data that we do have today that we should put MSI on top of everything. MSI is one of the very important good prognostic factors. If the tumor is MSI, then the outcome of the patients is clearly better than if the tumor is MSS. But take the example, for instance, of a 40-year-old man with a microsatellite instable tumor, an MSI, and a T4, poorly differentiated tumor. This patient, and that's a rare situation, but to this patient we will propose adjuvant chemotherapy. So MSI doesn't overrule everything, but it's one of the important factors, as is T3 versus T4. So today we test all patients with stage 2 for MSI status because it's relevant. But again, it's not black and white. It comes into the whole algorithm of a high risk versus low risk stage 2 colon cancer. The other tests, Coloprint, Oncotype DX, are interesting. But again, they are prognostic. They're not used in Europe because they're not commercially available yet in Europe. There are a couple of issues, like with the Coloprint, for instance, you still need fresh tumor. You can't do it yet today. That will evolve probably.
So same issue as Mammaprint and breast cancer.
Correct. You cannot yet do it on a paraffin-embedded tumor. My guess and prediction is that will change in the future. In this situation, for instance, let's suppose that it changes and it becomes available, then I do believe that they will become important to further distinguish, and Josep Tabernero will present here some interesting data, again from another validation set on Coloprint, that they will become important in this whole treatment algorithm because it seems that they will further discriminate on top of histologic criteria. They will not be there, to my opinion, to forget about histology and to throw away the microscope in stage 2 and to look into the other criteria, the poor prognostic criteria. But on top of that, they will help us further to discriminate this group of patients. So my prediction is that in the future we will use them. Today we don't use them for these reasons. And Oncotype DX is not available in Europe. I know it's available in the US. There are clearly also some issues in that sense that it's mainly prognostic. It's not predictive. It doesn't help to predict for a patient whether he will have benefits of 5-FU or not. And then there is the issue also, it's not a black and white test, but it's put in the whole algorithm and quartiles. The interpretation of the test is not easy. And for the patients, it's not easy neither to do a correct interpretation.
It is available in the United States. It's being ordered, but not as frequently as you can imagine in breast cancer, where it's, you know, part of standard care and it's completely changed the way breast cancer is managed. But in terms of the colon, you know, the paper was finally published. You know, it had been presented a couple of years ago from the QUASAR study. It was published. There was an editorial by Al Benson. I keep reading it and trying to understand it. And one thing that was kind of weird is that in the original presentation, they sort of said that it did predict benefit. But then in the paper, they actually say in their words that it didn't predict chemo benefit, but it was prognostic. And to my, I always am trying to simplify things. I mean, if you have a definitely greater risk of recurrence, and in their high risk was 22%, I mean, that's not small. Wouldn't you assume that if the risk were 22% versus 11%, that you would see more risk reduction, even though maybe they couldn't demonstrate it in this study?
Yeah, you would assume, but it's not because you assume that it's clearly there. And
it's not a greater relative risk, what you see in breast cancer.
And again, it's not black and white in this situation. And the major reason I see, or one of the major reasons why it's not being used widely, is the fact that indeed there is no positive demonstration of this prediction. It's mainly prognostic. It's no positive demonstration of the benefit or the lack of benefit or benefit of 5-FU in this setting. And the way colon cancer doctors, before they adopt any new treatment options or tests in this, we usually want to have clear evidence today. And we need a bit more evidence, especially on the predictive value, before these tests will be adopted. But of course, if you have color print, Oncotype DX, and if all different tests can be easily done on a paraffin-embedded tumor tissue, and if we will have a bit more validation sets, then there may be a gradual integration of these tests. But these days, oncologists and payers look very critical if you have a first data set before implementing this, especially if it's not black and white.
And if you think about it, you know, in breast cancer, you're looking at what's the chemo benefit on top of hormone therapy in ER-positive patients, which is already very, you know, strong benefit. But on the other hand, in terms of colorectal cancer, one thing you have that you don't have in breast cancer is an option for oral non-alopecic adjuvant therapy. In breast cancer, you're going to lose your hair and not feel too good and get injections. You do have capecitabine out there in colon cancer. Does that change the way it plays out?
Yeah, that's probably important. Also, the push towards, let's say, more adopting these tests, yes or no, would be great if you would have more treatment options also for these patients. Because that's what drives, let's say, looking for predictive tests. If you don't have a lot of treatment options, then, let's say, clinical practice is not always changed in this setting. And then the push and the drive for adopting and using one of these tests on good data. But we need a bit more confirmation on larger data sets also and other data sets. Then the drive will be there if you would have more treatment options.
Yeah, it'd be good if some kind of, you know, hormone-like therapy or target came with some of these GI cancers.
Correct.
I think I read Dr. Benson's editorial as him suggesting that the Oncotype B, it was the editorial for the Oncotype paper, the Oncotype be considered in patients who have, you know, one or more adverse pathologic factors. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's too early?
You can look at different ways at this test. You can look in the patients with the really good risk patients, and you can look at, say, we want to see the better risk patients to find out with this better risk patients histological criteria whether we can find a group of patients that will still have a relapse, and then use this test to put them in the other categories. So that's one way you can look at that. What Al Benson said is the other way around of thinking, which is probably the way we think usually in colon cancer, that the patients with unfavorable criteria but who don't relapse, because not all patients with unfavorable criteria do relapse. If you can find out and sort out and filter out in this group of patients with stage 2 unfavorable criteria, patients that will not relapse by a gene signature, that that could be the way to go forward so that you can spare them from all the burden of a chemotherapy that they don't need. And that's what Al wrote. And that's probably the way to go, that we have to look at these data with Oncotype DX, but also with ColorPrint. That's the same way. The data that will be presented here at this meeting, that's the same way you should look at these data when Jose Tabernero presents his curves.
Okay, let's talk about gastric cancer, particularly anti-HER2 treatment. Where are we right now with that strategy?
When I see it, at least in Europe, and what I hear from colleagues also in different parts of the world, is that many patients get tested right now. The initial experience in TOGA study reported a 22% positivity rate. What we see in clinical practice is that it's probably a little bit lower for different reasons. In the trial, there may have been a little bit of pre-selection by some investigators that pre-tested already locally their patients before sending a sample for central testing in this regard. But in average, we see, and that's what I hear also from many countries, that around 15% of patients are HER2 positive. And what we do, as well as many others, is first do an immunohistochemistry and then do a FISH testing. In some countries, they do both in parallel and then take a decision on the immunohistochemistry 3+ and the patients also with a 2+ and a FISH positive tumor, which is the official recommendation also. And that's being done.
In the beginning, there was a lot of discussion about the issue of heterogeneity in the HER2 expression, where it's expressed in the cell, and also the issue of sampling. Where is that now?
The heterogeneity remains an issue. In the beginning, this was even more a hot topic, but it's still an issue today because of the learning curve and some of the differences with breast cancer. Breast cancer tumors seem to be less heterogeneous than gastric tumors. The general recommendation is that if you look into endoscopic biopsies, for instance, which is often the case in gastric cancer, then at least the pathologist should look at the whole set of biopsies, should look at least, we don't have a final number, but the pathologist should look at least 6 endoscopic biopsies. And that's, let's say, a consensus more based on experience than on evidence from randomized trials.
And would you subscribe to the TOGA-like approach that if either you see an IHC of 3+ or FISH positivity, quote, it's HER2 positive?
Yes, immunohistochemistry 3+, and then the patients with 2+ or FISH positive.
2+.
2+ followed by FISH positive.
And that's, FISH positive.
That's the official, let's say, the official recommendation, the official label that has been granted to trastuzumab.
I know it's not common, but if you saw a 1+ or 0 that was FISH positive, what would you do?
In my country, in Belgium, and in my practice, we would treat the patient because that also would fit in the reimbursement criteria of trastuzumab. We've looked into the TOGA data in the more than 3,000 samples and have been looking at correlation between immunohistochemistry and FISH testing, and there was close to 90% correlation. So it's not perfect, but there is a quite good correlation. Immunohistochemistry is not always easy, and as we mentioned, there is a learning curve. The tumors are heterogeneous in this setting, so yes, a patient with a 1+ followed by a FISH positive, in our setting, this would be a patient that would be eligible.
So what else is out there in terms of randomized trial data that's either been reported or maturing that's addressing the same issue of chemotrastuzumab in advanced gastric?
No data from randomized trials are out. What we have seen is a couple of, let's say, phase 2 trials looking combining trastuzumab with other backbones of chemotherapy. In the TOGA trial, it was a fluoropyrimidine, capecitabine or 5-FU plus cisplatin. There are some data from smaller studies with docetaxel, with taxanes, in combination with trastuzumab. They show that it's feasible, as we expected, of course, in breast cancer. This is a good combination also. These are data from non-randomized trials, so they don't help us very much in evidence-based algorithms. What is going on right now are some different trials, and we're looking forward to that. Different trials with lapatinib. There is a large randomized trial with capecitabine, oxaliplatin, plus or minus lapatinib, first line. So the Xelox regimen plus or minus lapatinib, that's a large trial, the LOGIC trial it's called, that's almost ending recruitment. And then a bit at the longer future, we now have started a protocol with combining trastuzumab plus pertuzumab. Like in breast cancer, we have seen interesting data being presented recently of the combination of trastuzumab plus pertuzumab. And so what we're doing is now
Cleopatra study. That was at San Antonio last month. So what's the actual design of what you're going to do?
What we're doing right now is first start with the phase one run-in, and then a randomized phase two study of chemo plus trastuzumab plus or minus pertuzumab.
Why did you do phase one?
It's a small run-in because the chemo backbone is different.
Oh, right, right.
It's a capecitabine cisplatin backbone, so it's slightly different. We don't expect any problems in the phase one, but at least you have to do a phase one with a few dose levels in this setting. And then the main part of this protocol will be a phase two with capecitabine cisplatin, trastuzumab plus or minus pertuzumab in a phase two study in HER2-positive patients.
Yeah, that breast cancer trial was kind of surprising. When you look at the mechanism, I think a lot of people didn't expect to see that kind of bump they saw. It was a pretty solid improvement.
It was an impressive improvement. I agree with that. Yeah, mechanistically, there are some explanations. Pertuzumab and trastuzumab bind to different epitopes on the HER2 receptor, but even that binding on the different epitopes, the magnitude of the benefit was indeed bigger than what many expected, but the data are the data, and that's good, and so that's why it's important also to look at that in these patients with HER2-positive gastric cancer.
Yeah, that's on its way to the adjuvant setting now in breast, the AFFINITY trial. You know, getting back to this issue of lapatinib, and for that matter, capecitabine, one of the oncologists in practice in one of our programs recently asked an interesting question, which was, what do we know about absorption of agents like this in people who had gastric surgery?
Of capecitabine, there are data. There are PK data from the older times. The Scottish group, Jim Cassidy and Jeff Evans, have been looking at that. In the phase one data times of capecitabine, looking at the PKs in patients who underwent a gastrectomy versus patients who didn't undergo a gastrectomy. And it seems that there is no problem, that the PK pattern was very similar. So we have strong data, solid data on capecitabine in this group of patients.
How about lapatinib?
I'm not aware of any data. Probably there are available, but I'm not aware of any data. But I can't cite them. I don't think there was an issue. That question has been addressed. Also, at the moment, the trials were designed also for the Asian trials, the phase three trials in this situation.
So, of course, everybody's out there saying, what about T-DM1? We've seen a lot of interesting things in breast cancer. Is that going to be looked at in gastric cancer?
It would be logic to look at that in gastric cancer, of course, because of the very interesting data in breast cancer. My prediction is somebody will look at that. We are at the moment with our group not looking into that, but that's a question. There is only a certain number of patients with HER2-positive gastric cancer. You can't look into everything at the same time. But I guess that will be done also in the future. But of course, T-DM1 is not yet approved. It has to be done in agreement also with the company who develops this drug.
So I think I've asked you this question before, but it might be interesting to get an update, which is, what about other tumors, you know, lung cancer, ovarian cancer, in terms of anti-HER therapy? And, you know, are we going to have to keep doing individual trials in each tumor, or at some point are we going to be able to target the target?
Yeah, the optimal scenario and the dream of every oncologist is, of course, that we can target a target, but there are still issues in that, of course. One of the issues is that the targeted agent on itself is not enough. It's active, but it's not enough. So you have to combine it with the actual knowledge and with the actual targeted agents, at least in this situation when we're talking on anti-HER2, with a chemotherapy backbone, which is already different for the different disease sites. So that's a major hurdle. If we would have an important pathway that we can block, BRAF, whatever, and that pathway would be the same across different tumor types in the same, let's say, of the same importance across the different tumor types, then that could be the optimal scenario, of course. But we have learned also that BRAF mutant patients, for instance, if you give that example, in melanoma, targeting with a BRAF inhibitor in BRAF mutant melanoma patients gives a much bigger activity than, for instance, in BRAF mutant colorectal cancer. So we cannot say that targeting the BRAF mutation in melanoma and in colorectal cancer, even if you're speaking about the same mutation, that results in the same effect. So the escape mechanisms or the other, when we block one pathway and the other, let's say, feedback loops, escape loops, may be different in different tumor types. And these tumors are not driven by one single mutation.
So we're also seeing some kind of interesting different anti-angiogenic strategies that I'm not sure I understand in terms of how they actually work, beginning with ramucirumab. Maybe you can explain that one to me.
Ramucirumab is a new antibody that targets the receptor with a broader activity. It doesn't bind to the circulating VEGF like bevacizumab, but targets the receptor. And yeah, with some preclinical rationale, so it may have a stronger effect at least. And in view also of the fact that angiogenesis may play an important role in gastric cancer, we have seen some role with bevacizumab. The idea was to look into this drug in gastric cancer, as well as, for instance, in colon cancer.
But so just again, kind of trying to simply understand it, is it correct, for example, that ramucirumab more effectively blocks the various VEGF pathways than, say, bevacizumab?
It may be the case, but the proof is always in the clinical results. And we don't know that blocking this more tightly and broader, like aflibercept, also interferes not only with VEGF-A, but also VEGF-B and PLGF. Whether that leads to a more profound clinical effect, that has to be shown in clinical practice. That's not yet clear, that's not yet proven, of course. But at least the rationale is clearly there, and we will see the outcome of the trial, of course.
And what do we know right now clinically about ramucirumab, both in terms of efficacy in gastric cancer, as well as tolerability, VEGF-like things?
We don't know a lot of information. We don't have information from phase two studies. It went up from a rationale, a preclinical rationale, feasibility of the drug, and then knowing that also in gastric cancer, blocking angiogenesis may be relevant. So it went immediately to the phase three trial. That phase three trial is running right now. That's a phase three trial in second line of paclitaxel plus or minus ramucirumab. And I believe there is also, but I'm not sure of the design, an early line trial with ramucirumab in gastric cancer in this setting. But the phase three studies are ongoing. Until now, they are progressing. I guess the whole program is being evaluated at regular time points by an IDMC because there was no phase two experience. And until now, the whole program is ongoing according to the publicly available information.
What do we know about things like proteinuria and hypertension?
Data haven't been disclosed, are not yet available, so we will see that in bigger trials. If you look at another drug, aflibercept, that is also broader activity compared to bevacizumab in cross-trial comparisons, although it has a broader activity and in theory a better activity compared to bevacizumab, when we look at the mechanisms, the VEGF-related adverse events were not more pronounced in the aflibercept versus the bevacizumab data sets. If you look at the frequency of hypertension, proteinuria, thrombosis, what was different with aflibercept compared to bevacizumab is that aflibercept increased the chemotherapy-related adverse events, being stomatitis, diarrhea, neutropenia, fatigue. And that was more pronounced when aflibercept was combined with chemo compared to chemo alone. We don't have a good explanation. Some have suggested that blocking PLGF, the placenta growth factor, may play a role in the fact that the chemotherapy-related adverse events were increased. There were some knockout models that have been looking at that, but some others haven't confirmed that in knockout models for PLGF. So the mechanism of this increase of chemotherapy-related adverse events is not completely elucidated, with some suggestions that it is related to placenta growth factor inhibition, with some other suggestions that this is not the case.
Now, when you talk about aflibercept, these trials, you're talking about CRs, colon cancer?
Correct.
When you've had patients getting aflibercept, although I'm not sure you've known that, I don't know, is it placebo-controlled usually?
It is placebo-controlled, yes. We did initially the phase 1 study where it was open, and then there was a phase 1b study where we treated quite a lot of patients doing DCI, MRI. These data have been presented in the past. So in this setting, it was an open study. But then later on in colorectal cancer, it was a randomized double-blind study.
So, but sometimes even when it's double blind, you can kind of see what's going on, which leads me to the question of, do you think you yourself saw in your own patients this accelerated chemotoxicity?
Yes, we saw that in two different trials where I used aflibercept, the phase 1 and the extension of the phase 1, so phase 1b or 2a trial, where we treated some patients with colon cancer that were refractory to all agents, and then later on we treated them with FOLFIRI plus aflibercept. We saw some nice responses in some patients, but we also saw some of these patients who tolerated FOLFIRI perfectly, who had then more diarrhea, more stomatitis, and a bit more hematologic toxicity. So in this situation, the patient was his own control, and we could see that. And also, I treated quite a lot of patients in the phase 3 trial when you see that with a lot of experience, you can have an idea. And that's indeed what you saw, that you saw a bit more chemotherapy-related toxicities such as stomatitis and diarrhea compared to what you usually see with FOLFIRI. So I think the data are real based on these two experiences.
How about myelosuppression?
Slightly more also. And that went together in some patients with the diarrhea and the stomatitis, and that led also to fatigue in some of these patients.
So at a basic level, I think I understand how bevacizumab works. It binds to VEGF. I think I understand, based on what you're saying, that ramucirumab is an antibody that hits the receptor on the cell. I'm not sure exactly which one. But what about aflibercept? What's the actual mechanism? What is it, and what does it actually do?
Aflibercept is a fusion protein that is composed of parts of the different receptors and that then binds to and interferes with VEGF-A, B, and PLGF. So it's in fact a fusion protein. With a nice drawing, it would be more clear if you want to illustrate that, to explain that. But it's in fact a fusion protein that then neutralizes not only VEGF-A, but also on top of that B and PLGF, placenta growth factor.
So, I mean, it started out as VEGF trap when I first heard about it, which kind of explains what it's doing.
Correct.
But it sort of sounds a lot like what bevacizumab's doing.
Yeah.
It's soaking up the ligand. Is that the case?
That's partly the case, but it's a bit broader, at least in the preclinical setting. It's also the VEGF-B and the PLGF.
So more of the ligands, but it's still not doing anything on the cell or the receptors.
Yeah.
Okay.